Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. It's early morning on October 5th, 1986. An American cargo plane soars through the skies above Costa Rica, headed for Nicaragua. On board are two pilots, a radio operator, and a single passenger. The passenger checks the cargo at the back of the plane to ensure everything is secure. It's a routine mission, but the cargo today is far from ordinary. In the back of the plane are 70 Soviet-made AK-47s, 100,000 rounds of ammunition, rocket-propelled grenades, and other military supplies.
Descending to 2,500 feet. Roger that.
The passenger thought his day's flying missions like this were over, but a call to fly over Nicaragua and drop boxes of cargo a few months back seemed like easy money. He's flown this route more than a dozen times.
Stand by for the drop. Standing by.
The passenger opens the cargo door and looks down. 2,500 feet is a long way to fall. He tightens the straps of the parachute on his back. Then he looks down at the majestic Rio San Juan River, winding its way to the Caribbean Sea. It's beautiful, a vista he never tires of seeing. But there is something else below the passenger does not see, or someone, rather. A teenage soldier named Jose Alemán, who's packing some military equipment of his own, a Russian-made, shoulder-mounted, surface-to-air rocket launcher. When Alemán sees the plane, he hoists the weapon to his shoulder, trains his sights up, and fires. As the plane nosedives towards the ground, the passenger closes his eyes and leaps, pulling the ripcord on his chute. The plane continues downward in a trail of smoke, crashing into the dense jungle. When the passenger touches down, he unhooks his chute and keeps moving. Whoever was shooting at him would probably try to finish the job. For the next 24 hours, he creeps through the jungle, dodging his pursuers and hiding in the trees. Finally, out of sheer exhaustion, he rigs a makeshift hammock and falls into a restless sleep. When he opens his eyes at daybreak, the first thing he sees is a barrel of a gun. Behind the barrel is the face of a young man in green fatigues who says, "What now, Rambo?" The Sandinista National Liberation Front, or the Sandinistas for short, is a socialist political party in Nicaragua. They first came to power 7 years earlier when they overthrew a dictatorship friendly to the United States. The Reagan administration has been vocally supportive of a rebel group called the Contras, who are trying to regain control. The weapons on board the cargo plane were meant for them. The day after the crash, the Sandinista government holds a press conference and puts the captured man in front of a television camera to tell the world who he is and who sent him.
My name is Gene Housen, folks.
And where you're from?
From Marinette, Wisconsin.
Did you tell us how you came to be here?
Shot out of the sky.
The crux of Eugene Hasenfuss's statement is this. The CIA coordinated the mission to deliver weapons to the Contras in Nicaragua. And that is a big deal, because delivering weapons to the Contras in Nicaragua is illegal. Sandinista officials hold up ID cards of the three Americans who died when the plane was shot down. They identify them as agents for the CIA. The U.S. response is quick. Shortly after the Hasenfuss press conference, Secretary of State George Shultz takes the podium in the White House press briefing room and denies what Hasenfuss has said.
I don't see that has any particular Reykjavik spinoff to it. The people involved were not from our military, not from any U.S. government agency, and CIA included. So these are private citizens, and it's not a governmental operation.
But one man watching the conference from his office knows what Shultz said isn't true. The CIA is involved, as are multiple White House officials and members of the National Security Council, or the NSC. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North knows this because he works for the NSC. And when it comes to the U.S. Contra operation, codenamed Project Democracy, Ollie is the man behind the curtain. When the Hasenfuss shootdown happens, Ollie is in Europe on national security business. When he hears the news, he gets on a plane and flies straight back to D.C. Not long after he arrives, he's summoned by Bill Casey, director of the CIA. North and Casey have been working together on Project Democracy for years. At the meeting, Bill Casey doesn't mince words.
The operation is over, Ollie. Shut it down.
Ollie doesn't have to ask why. He understands the implications of the capture of Hasenfuss. But there's one question that's been spinning through his mind since the plane went down.
Bill, am I going to be blamed for this? Ollie, if the truth comes out, this will go way above your head, buddy. Just shut it down. Clean it up.
The Marine Corps motto is Semper Fidelis, or for short, Semper Fi. It means always faithful. Ollie was a platoon commander in Vietnam who earned 2 Purple Hearts and a Bronze and Silver Star for his courage and leadership. When Bill Casey instructs Ollie to shut down the operation, Ollie, always faithful, gets right to work. But no matter what Casey says, Ollie knows the truth. If the whole story goes public, and if the depth of his involvement is revealed, Ollie is going to find himself in the line of fire. American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. Two separate storylines converge to create Iran-Contra. Two covert operations in two countries, Iran and Nicaragua. In our previous episode, we followed Bud McFarlane in the Iran thread of the story as he worked to advance one of President Reagan's top priorities, getting back U.S. hostages kidnapped by terrorists in Lebanon. In this episode, we'll go back to the spring of 1984 and follow another of Ronald Reagan's priorities, the Contras in Nicaragua. We'll take a trip to Central America and trace the operation's inception to the moment it converges with the Iran arms deal. If you haven't heard episode one, we suggest going back and giving it a listen. In the early 1980s, the Contras are one of President Reagan's personal causes. He sees the Contras as patriots who are fighting for liberty against the communist Sandinistas, and they deserve America's full and unflinching support. Reagan gives it to them from day one of his presidency: arms, weapons, and CIA assistance. But Democrats in Congress don't share Reagan's zeal. They worry about starting another Vietnam. Many believe the United States has no business overthrowing governments. And many increasingly feel Reagan isn't being truthful about his intentions in Nicaragua. When Democrats sweep the House in 1982, 2 years into Reagan's first term, Congress passes the Boland Amendment. The Boland Amendment basically says the government cannot use taxpayer funds to try and overthrow the government of Nicaragua. Congress's message to Reagan is clear. Don't go too far. We're watching you. That's a problem for Reagan, because he views supporting the Contras as a key to keeping America safe from the growing spread of communism in Central America. Not long after the amendment passes, Reagan tells his national security advisor, Bud McFarlane, "I want you to do whatever you have to do to help these people keep body and soul together." Bud is a soldier at heart who takes his job seriously. He needs a strong team to achieve Reagan's mission with strong leadership. The man Bud taps to get the job done is Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. This is Iran-Contra, Episode 2, Ali. It's late spring 1984 in Washington, D.C., 2.5 years before the cargo plane is shot out of the sky over Nicaragua. Ali North sits at his desk in the old executive office building, an ornate structure just west of the White House. Ali is a career military man, and he looks the part, handsome, with a strong jawline and clear gray eyes. Ali is a workhorse who stays late every day, cranking out ideas for pushing Reagan's agenda. But today, his work is interrupted by a knock at the door. It's Bud McFarlane, head of the National Security Council and Ali's boss.
Bud, what can I do for you? Ali, I want you to have the Nicaraguan resistance open up an offshore bank account so that foreign contributors can make direct deposits to the cause.
The Nicaraguan resistance, or the Contras, is a collective term for Nicaraguan rebels fighting the Sandinista government. What Bud is asking Ali to do is flirting with a legal gray area. But Ali doesn't ask questions. He believes in the chain of command.
I'll get right to it. Thank you, Ali.
After Bud leaves, Ali walks down the hall to the office of CIA Director Bill Casey.
Bill, do you have a minute?
Yeah, close the door.
What do you need?
I've been told to have the resistance set up an offshore account. I could use some help.
Casey chews on a yellow pencil and leans back in his chair. After a moment, he picks up a secure phone and dials a number.
This is Bill. Tell me, if a third party wanted to help our friends down south, who can we trust to handle the money?
Right. Thank you. Adolfo Calero. He's your man.
Ali knows Calero well. Calero is a prominent Nicaraguan businessman and a leader in the Contra Revolution. Ali has made several trips to Central America over the past few years to meet with Calero and to help him transport weapons and supplies.
Have Calero set up an offshore account. The money shouldn't come all at once. Regular payments, once a month. Here's how you run this. Pay attention.
Ali takes out a pen and paper.
Ali, put that away. If you have to write everything down, you don't belong in this business. Now, the money should go from the foreign account directly into Calero's account. It shouldn't come into the United States at all.
Right, understood.
Ali gets up to leave the room.
Ali, wait. Is it the Saudis?
I don't know.
Come on, don't bullshit me.
Honestly, I don't know.
It's got to be the Saudis. How much are we talking about?
I don't know that either.
Bill's educated guess is spot on. The Boland Amendment makes it illegal for the United States to give money to the Contras, but it doesn't say anything about that money coming from another country. In the summer of 1984, Bud exploits that loophole and secures a promise to fund the Contras from a longtime U.S. ally, Saudi Arabia. Since the early 80s, the U.S. has been selling the Saudis weapons, high-tech weapons other U.S. allies don't get access to. Now it was time to return the favor. The Saudis offer support for the Contras to the tune of $1 million a month. In June, 3 months after Oliver North's meeting with Bill Casey, the president meets with the National Security Planning Group, or the NSPG, to discuss the situation in Nicaragua. The NSPG is made up of President Reagan's top advisors, some of the most powerful people in the country. But today, the Situation Room belongs to Ali North's boss, National Security Advisor Bud McFarlane. Because of the Boland Amendment, the Contras are running out of money and they're about to fail. The question is, how will the White House respond? One idea has floated. What if the U.S. solicits money for the Contras from another country? At this point, Bud might have spoken up. He might have told the NSPG that Saudi Arabia has already pledged support for the Contras. He might have also told them that the operation is already underway. But Bud doesn't say a word. He sits back quietly and lets Reagan's top advisors hash it out. George Shultz, the Secretary of State, says obtaining funds for the Contras through a third party is an impeachable offense. And impeachable is a word no one wants to hear, especially President Reagan. As usual, Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger finds himself on the opposite side of Shultz's argument. Weinberger is all for obtaining money from a third party. It's perfectly legal. End of story. And CIA Director Bill Casey agrees. Vice President Bush quietly takes it all in and then says, "How can anyone object to the U.S. encouraging third parties to provide help to the anti-Sandinistas, as long as we're not giving them something in return?" Schultz tells them that to move forward, Reagan will need the approval of the Attorney General. Everyone in the room agrees to wait before making a final decision. During the meeting, Bud never says a word about the Saudi payments. Maybe it's because deep down, Bud knows what he's doing is wrong. Bud does say this: "I certainly hope none of this discussion will be made public in any way." Everyone in the Situation Room turns to the president to see how he'll respond. "If such a story gets out," Reagan says, "we'll all be hanging by our thumbs in front of the White House until we find out who did it." Maybe Bud keeps his mouth closed because he knows Schultz is right. If this type of thing gets to the press, impeachment might be more than a forbidden word. Impeachment might very well be Reagan's new reality. But that fear doesn't stop Bud from moving forward. Violating the Boland Amendment may be wrong, but supporting the Contras and stopping the spread of communism is right. And for Bud, the ends justify the means. In the late summer of 1984, Ali takes a flight to Tegucigalpa, the capital city of Honduras. From there, he gets into a car and drives to a Contra safe house located in the residential area of the city. Ali's just a mid-level guy at the National Security Council, but to the Contras, meeting with Ali is a big deal. The men share a meal together: beans, rice, and chicken. They communicate through a translator, but Ali assures the men that even though Congress has cut off U.S. support, President Reagan promises he'll find a way around the ban. After dinner, Ali meets privately with Adolfo Calero, who is disappointed. "The Contras need money, and they need it now. Promises do them no good." And that's when Ali tells him he has more to offer than promises. There's a benefactor, but he can't say who. He instructs Calero to set up an offshore bank account and send him the account number, a telex code, and a wire transfer address. Calero asks how much they can expect. Ali tells him $1 million a month. It's not enough money to fund a revolution, but it's a start. Calero is pleased. But Ali leaves him with a warning: "No one can know I'm involved in this." Over the next few months, Ali and Calero stay in close communication. They talk on the phone regularly. They discuss every aspect of the resistance operation, from weapons to the Contras' need for good doctors to military strategy. And just as the Contra operation looks poised for success, Congress delivers another blow. Ali says that between 1982 and 85, the Boland Amendments were like an annual ritual. Each year, Reagan asked Congress for money to support the Contras, and each year, Congress says no and responds with another Boland Amendment. In October 1984, in response to stories in the press about the U.S. Contra operation, Congress passes another Boland Amendment, the strictest one so far. The law essentially states that funding the Contras in any way, shape, or form, directly or indirectly, is illegal. No more money, no more weapons, no more support. But after the 1984 Boland Amendment is passed in October, Project Democracy doesn't grind to a halt. It picks up speed. The monthly $1 million payments from the Saudis start in mid-1984 and continue through the end of the year. Then, in early 1985, the Saudis double their commitment. In total, from 84 to 86, the Saudis will contribute $32 million to the Contra operation. Throughout 1985, Ali oversees everything. He reports to Bud McFarlane and Bill Casey. He supplies the Contras with valuable intelligence, military advice, and $11 million in arms. He even secures $2 million of additional funding from Taiwan. But in spite of Ali's best efforts, the money isn't enough. By the end of 1985, the Contras are losing the fight against the Sandinistas. If something doesn't change, the Contras will fail. Ali's floundering, and not just with Project Democracy on the Nicaraguan front. He's involved in another covert operation in Iran, a secret deal to trade arms for hostages. On November 17, 1985, Ali gets a panic call from the Israeli defense minister, General Rabin. Rabin's first words: "We have a problem." Rabin talks so fast, Ali can barely keep up. Something about the shipment of Hawk missiles to Iran. Something about a plane not being allowed to land in Portugal. Ali cuts him off. He tells him, "We can't talk about this on the phone." He tells him, "We need to talk to Bud first." As Ali hangs up the phone, it rings again. It's Bud. Bud tells Ali the score. A large quantity of Hawk missiles were on the way to Iran, But the customs official in Lisbon, Portugal, wouldn't let the planes land. So the Israeli planes turned back and flew home to Tel Aviv. Bud is worried this snafu might upset the hostage negotiators and blow up the deal. Bud tells Ali to do whatever it takes to solve the problem and get the hostages back. According to Ali, Bud tells him something else, too. President Reagan has approved U.S. involvement. Ali will later say he had his doubts about the Iran operation. He knew the arms for hostages deal was wrong, but like Reagan, he wanted those hostages back. So when Bud asks him to save the mission, he leaps into action and does his best to finish it with the help of the CIA. But his best isn't good enough. The shipment is a disaster. Only 18 missiles are delivered, and none of them were the kind Iran was expecting. The Iranians are convinced Israel sabotaged the shipment, and if the Iranians start to blame the U.S. for the deal going sideways, there's a chance they'll hurt the hostages. As 1985 winds to a close, two of Reagan's top priorities are in jeopardy. The hostages are still in the hands of terrorists in Lebanon, and the Contras are losing their fight against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Ali is desperate to break the impasse and succeed on both fronts. In January 1986, he comes across a new plan, a plan that will bind the Iran and Contra operations together, the diversion. The diversion might help Ali North achieve the Reagan administration's goals in Iran and Nicaragua, but it will also push the White House closer to the precipice of scandal, and it'll push Ali North even closer to the line of fire.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery. When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Ali North will later say the diversion is what put the hyphen in Iran-Contra. It's the moment in this story when two separate operations in two separate countries collide to become one scandal. Ali also says the diversion was not his idea, although he wishes it was, because he'd love to take the credit. Instead, it was Maniker Gabanafar, the Iranian arms dealer who lined his pockets after the failed Hawk missile delivery in November 1985. Ali calls him Gorba. Bud had warned Ali to stay away from Gorba. He told him Gorba was not to be trusted, and Ali knew he was right. He knew Gorba was a shady character from the very beginning. He'd heard plenty of rumors. Gorba is only in it for himself. Gorba is a liar. Gorba has failed 3 CIA polygraph tests. But in early 1986, Gorba is the only option. Until someone better comes along, something, anything, is better than nothing. Because like Reagan, Ali is worried about the hostages rotting away in the Middle East. If Ali has to bend the rules to get them back or do business with a man he knows is untrustworthy, so be it. Here's how Ali tells it. In January 1986, 9 months before the Hazanfuss plane crash, Ali flies to London to meet with Gorba at his suite at the Churchill Hotel. The purpose of the meeting is to discuss an upcoming shipment of missiles to Iran. But during a break, Gorba pulls Ollie aside and takes him into the bathroom, turns on the faucets to let the water run in case the room is bugged. Then he tells Ollie in a low whisper that he has an idea, one Ollie will like. Gorba tells him, there's $1 million in it for you. This is the first time in his career that Ollie's been offered a bribe. And that's not how he operates. He tells Gorba it's out of the question. So Gorba makes a different offer. Maybe instead we can make some money available to your friends in Nicaragua. Well, now Gorba has Ollie's attention. After the meeting, Ollie gets on a plane and flies back to D.C. The first thing he does is make an appointment with his boss, the new national security advisor, John Poindexter. Poindexter is an enigmatic figure known for his fierce intelligence. He graduated first in his class from the Naval Academy and then went on to earn a Ph.D. in nuclear physics from the California Institute of Technology. He is also a thoughtful man who smokes a pipe and sees himself as a patriot. Like Ollie and most of the characters in this story, Poindexter is a true believer in the Reagan Doctrine, that communism and terrorism are the two greatest threats to American security. When Ollie walks into Poindexter's office in January of 1986, he gets right to the point. He says, I think we've found a way to support the Nicaraguan resistance. Ollie explains Gorba's plan. Instead of using Israel as a middleman, as they have been doing, the U.S. will sell missiles directly to Iran, mark up the price, and use the profits to fund the Contras. Two birds, one stone, the diversion. Poindexter likes the idea. It's a perfect way to benefit two of the president's policy priorities, getting the hostages back and supporting the Contras. Later that night, Poindexter calls Ollie on a secure line and orders him to proceed with the diversion. What happened to lead him to that decision depends on who you ask. Did he take it to the president or run it by anyone else? Or did he make a unilateral decision on his own? Here's what we do know. On January 17, 1986, Reagan signs a presidential finding, this one ordering Vice Admiral Poindexter and the CIA to drop the Israeli middlemen and negotiate a direct sale of arms from the U.S. to Iran. This January 1986 finding is never delivered to Congress. In February 1986, the diversion is off to the races. Over the next month, Poindexter oversees the operation, and Ollie handles the details. He gives the Contras military advice, coordinating directly with leaders on both sides of the deal. He runs point on everything from arms deliveries to negotiations with Iran to coordinating with the CIA for the Contra resupply effort. Soon, 1,000 missiles are delivered to Iran. With Poindexter's blessing, Ollie raises the price from $3.7 to $10 million. The extra $6.3 million are then diverted to the Contra program. So far, so good. Except that it's not, because no hostages are released, and the president doesn't understand why. His patience is wearing thin. With his back against the wall, Reagan reaches out to a former employee, a man who resigned when he thought Reagan wasn't listening to his advice. But Reagan is ready to listen now. He calls on Bud McFarlane. It's May 1986, 5 months before the plane carrying Eugene Hasenfuss is shot down. A group of Americans, a flight crew, sits in a hotel room in Tehran. But this isn't a bunch of vacationing pilots. The armed Iranian guards standing watch outside make that abundantly clear. A few days back, these men flew to Tehran with fake Irish passports and a plane load of spare parts for Hawk missiles. They brought something else, too.
Well, I guess they didn't like the cake. Nope, guess not.
It's a kosher cake, in the shape of a key, to be exact. The cake is meant to symbolize a new opening to Iran. They also brought a Bible with a handwritten message inscribed inside, signed by Ronald Reagan. But the cake and the Bible don't have the effect the Americans hope for. Instead of receiving a warm welcome, they are promptly put on house arrest.
We should offer them the equipment.
No. We're not giving them anything until we get what we want.
Well, we're not exactly in a position to negotiate, are we? If we offer them something, then...
I said no. We wait.
And just then, the door to the hotel room opens, and an Iranian man in a dark suit enters. He doesn't say a word. He walks directly to the telephone, picks it up, and dials a number. He holds out the receiver as if to say, it's for you. One of the Americans stands and takes the phone in his hands.
Hello? Yes, I'll hold...
The Americans exchange nervous glances. And then,
Mr. President, I sure am glad to hear your voice.
These men, captives in an Iranian hotel room, are high-level officials in the Reagan administration, part of a secret U.S. delegation sent to Tehran to negotiate for the release of American hostages. Among them are two men of particular importance, Ollie North and Bud McFarlane. Eventually, Bud, Ollie, and the other officials are let go, but they're going back to Washington empty-handed. That story is based on claims made by the Iranian government, claims reported on by major American news outlets. But the truth is, it's impossible to know what exactly happened in Iran. That's because the people involved tell a story very differently, even about the smallest details. In Ollie's version, there was no Bible, but there was a cake he bought at a bakery in Tel Aviv on his way to Iran. But Ollie swears it was not in the shape of a key. Bud says there was no cake at all. Then later, he walks that back, admitting, yes, there was a cake, but adding the strange caveat, I didn't bake it. But both men agree the Tehran trip was supposed to be a simple transaction. Fly to Tehran with a plane full of Hawk missile parts. When the Iranians release the hostages to the Americans, give them the Hawk parts and fly back home. Both men also agree the negotiations went horribly wrong, but they disagree on why. Ollie blames Bud. Ollie says in the middle of heated negotiations, the Iranians offer up two hostages in exchange for the parts, and Bud blew his top. The deal was for all the hostages, not two. Ollie says Bud stormed out of the room, and he had to chase after him and beg him to reconsider. Two hostages were better than none, he told him, but Bud refused to listen and cut off the negotiations. Bud McFarlane tells it a different way. He says when the president called and asked him to go to Tehran, he couldn't refuse. Resigning his post as National Security Advisor was the hardest thing he ever did, and he still wanted to serve. He would later tell the Washington Post that he started the Arms for Hostages mess. In Bud's mind, going to Tehran was the only way to convince the president once and for all that the Iran initiative would never work. And from the moment their plane landed on the tarmac, Bud says it was obvious the Iranians were not on the up and up. No one was there to greet them, and they were forced to wait for 2 hours in a holding area until Ghorbanifar finally showed his face. From there, Gorba escorted them to a hotel and told them to wait for the Iranian officials to arrive. 2 days went by, and no one showed up. While waiting in the hotel, Bud learned that the Iranians had already violated the deal. They had unloaded the weapons without permission. Then, when the Iranians finally did show up, they only offered two hostages. In Bud's view, these men were not acting in good faith, so he killed the deal. It's not that these discrepancies about keys and cakes matter, but they are emblematic of a greater issue with the Iran-Contra affair. The characters don't always remember things the same way. They're unreliable narrators, which makes the truth difficult to wrestle to the ground. On the way back to Washington, Bud and Ollie have a layover in Tel Aviv. On the tarmac at Ben-Gurion Airport, Bud orders the CIA radio man to get John Poindexter on the line so he can give him the bad news. Ollie taps Bud on the shoulder as he passes. Don't worry, Bud. It's not a total loss. At least we're using some of the Ayatollah's money in Central America. Ollie is referring to the diversion, where money from arms sales is being funneled to the Contras. But Bud is confused. He has no idea what Ollie is talking about. But if what Ollie just said is true, then Bud knows the mess he started has grown into something worse than he'd ever imagined. Before Bud can ask Ollie any questions, the CIA radio man hands him the handset. Poindexter's on the line. Bud's message to the man who replaced him as National Security Advisor is brief. We did not get the hostages back. Tell the president I'm sorry. Ollie says the flight back to Washington is a quiet one. He says that when they land at Dulles Airport, he and Bud go to the White House together to brief the president in the Oval Office. Bud says he tells the president the same thing he told him before he resigned. Stop negotiations. They will never work. But Bud doesn't say anything to Reagan about Ollie's comment on the tarmac, about using Iran's money to support the Contras. It's not hard to imagine why, because it's not hard to imagine that in May of 1986, Bud sees the writing on the wall. If money from the arms sales is going to the Contras instead of the United States Treasury, then that's a serious crime. And if this information were ever to go public, the fallout would be catastrophic. Investigations, hearings, impeachment. After the failed negotiations in Tehran, Ollie is angry. Bud should have at least asked permission to get the two hostages back. Ollie's certain Reagan would have given Bud the go-ahead to make the deal. But in the meeting with Reagan, Ollie doesn't say a word. Instead, he resolves to do what Bud could not, get the hostages back.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's what happens when you give Grammarly to your entire team. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Ollie North has always been something of a loose cannon. Depending on who you ask, he's either stark raving mad or a mad genius. Ollie didn't balk when Bud tapped him to manage the Iran and Contra operations. He didn't question the legal ramifications of either. He dove right in and he took charge. Maybe that's because Ollie sees himself as something of a dark knight, a hero who will do whatever it takes to keep America safe. He is more than willing to fight the bad guys, even if it means breaking the law. Or maybe Ollie didn't think the Iran and Contra operations were illegal. Or maybe he didn't think it mattered because he believed he was operating with President Reagan's blessing. But there is no doubt Ollie sees himself as a patriot, and a man who doesn't back down from a fight, especially if it means protecting the country. And in the late summer of 1986, Ollie has a big fight on his hands. His opponent, the United States Congress. It's August 6th, 1986, 2 months before the Hasenfuss plane crash. Reagan has finally convinced Congress to loosen up the Boland Amendment and support his goals in Nicaragua. Now, there's a $100 million appropriations bill for the Contras pending in Congress. While most of the Republicans in the room want to start funding the Contras as soon as possible, the Democrats are not going to fund anything until they get some answers. Ollie North sits in the president's chair in the Situation Room across from several members of the House Intelligence Committee. There have been rumors in the press about Ollie's Contra activities, potentially illegal activities. The mood in the room is tense. Lee Hamilton, a Democrat and the chair of the Intelligence Committee, leads off the proceedings.
Mr. North, thank you for meeting with us today. I'm happy to do it, sir.
But that's not true. Ollie's not happy to do it. The only reason he is here at all is because his boss, John Poindexter, ordered him to sit down with the congressman. Ollie told Poindexter he would have to bend the truth. You can handle it, Ollie, Poindexter told him. But today, sitting across from these congressmen, Ollie isn't so sure.
Mr. North, all we ask is that you tell us the truth. Of course, sir.
The congressmen fire off a slew of questions about Ollie's alleged Contra activities. But Ollie knows the Contra operation is just the tip of the iceberg. The congressmen don't know about the diversion. They don't know about arms for hostages. And they don't know that after his failed trip to Tehran, Ollie ditched Gorbanifar and opened up a second channel to Iran to keep the operation alive. Ollie has to be very, very careful about what he says next and how he says it.
Mr. North, did you give the Contras military advice? I'm a military man, Congressman. When I sit down with military people, it's inconceivable that we don't talk about military things. But even if I thought I could give them advice, you and I both know this war can't be run from Washington.
It's a non-answer, and that's by design. it's also a lie. Ali has been giving Adolfo Calero and other Contra leaders military advice for years. But if Ali tells the truth, he'll be admitting he violated the Boland Amendment. Though there's no criminal penalty for such a violation, Ali could lose his job, not to mention be publicly disgraced, dragged in front of Congress for hours of public testimony. But even more importantly, telling the truth could spell disaster for President Reagan and for the Contras.
One last question. Did you personally ever raise money for the Contras?
No, sir, I did not.
Well, thank you for your time, Mr. North.
Ali leaves the meeting at peace with his decision. Yes, he lied, but he lied for the right reasons. He lied to protect the president and preserve the Contras, body and soul. 2 days after the meeting, on August 8, 1986, John Poindexter sends Ali a private message. Two simple words that say it all: well done. The House Intelligence Committee is also satisfied. The inquiry into the Contra operation is closed. Over the next 2 months, the $100 million appropriations bill makes its way through Congress and passes in both the House and the Senate. The final step is the Budget Committee reconciling the funds, and then the bill will be ready for the president's signature. But then, on October 5th, 1986, a plane carrying 70 AK-47s, 100,000 rounds of ammunition and rocket-propelled grenades is shot out of the sky over Nicaragua. And when the sole survivor, Eugene Hasenfuss, is paraded in front of the press, he tells the world the CIA coordinated the flight. Sometime after the crash, Ali gets his orders from the CIA director Bill Casey. Shut down the operation. Clean it up. So Ali gets to work. He picks up the phone and calls his people on the ground in Nicaragua. He orders them to leave the country and return to the United States immediately. The CIA gets down to business too. Agents fly all U.S. planes and equipment in Nicaragua to a remote airfield. The agents use bulldozers to dig a massive ditch and fill it with explosives. Then they push the entire fleet into the hole and blow it to bits. The remaining scraps are doused with fuel and incinerated in a fire that burns for days. A few days after the crash, Eugene Hasenfuss's captors grant him an interview with Mike Wallace to air on 60 Minutes, where he describes a clandestine network that ferried tons of supplies to the rebels. In a scandal where the key players often lie, dissemble, and change their stories to serve themselves, Hasenfuss is one of the only people who tells the truth. Throughout the month of October, Congress investigates the plane crash, but repeated denials from the White House, as well as from the CIA and the State Department, stymie the inquiry, and the issue is put to bed for the time being. On October 21st, 1986, Reagan signs the budget bill, bringing an end to the need for the diversion. The Reagan administration can now fund the Contras out in the open. Mission accomplished, at least for a fleeting moment. Because less than 2 weeks after the budget is enacted, in early November of 1986, the other shoe drops. Al-Shara, a Lebanese news magazine, publishes a bombshell. A story the American people know nothing about. An expose that blows the Iran scandal wide open. Al-Shara claims the United States sold arms to Iran. The article also outlines Bud McFarlane and Ali North's secret trip to Tehran to trade arms for hostages. The story is picked up by news media in the U.S. and in papers all over the world. The details are confirmed by a high-level official in the Iranian government. This presents a major problem for the Reagan administration, and it leads to questions with potentially impeachable consequences. What did President Reagan know, and when did he know it? Almost immediately, Reagan's cabinet builds a wall of protection around the president. Someone must take the blame for this, but it won't be Reagan. Instead, the scapegoats chosen include Bud McFarlane and his right-hand man, Ali North. From Wondery, this is episode 2 of 6 of Iran-Contra for American Scandal. On the next episode, we follow Don Regan as he walls off the president, shields him from a media firestorm, and goes looking for a head to put on a spike. If you'd like to learn more about Iran-Contra, we recommend the book Iran-Contra: Reagan's Scandal and the Unchecked Abuse of Presidential Power by Michael Byrne. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details. And while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Scandal is hosted, edited, sound designed, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Additional production assistance by Derek Behrens. This episode is written by Stephen Walters, edited by Andrew Stelzer. Our consultant is Malcolm Byrne. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marsha Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
I love a good parasocial relationship with a celebrity who will probably never know my name.
I mean, honestly, who knows? Don't count yourself out. But my favorite part about these feuds is how they're ignited by the tiniest things.
Jada, I love you. G.I. Jane 2, can't wait to see it.
I accidentally laminated my brows too much.
It starts small and then it gets so big.
To be honest, Naomi, I'm fearful of you to this day.
I don't know her.
We all just have to admit, we're addicted. Everybody has opinions. Everyone picks sides.
Leave Britney Spears alone right now.
From Wondery, I'm Sydney Battle.
And I'm Matt Bellassai.
And this is Dis and Tell, la, 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 where we unpack why we get so invested in these feuds and whether or not our attention only makes the whole thing worse.
Follow Dis and Tell wherever you get your podcasts.